Everybody's favorite auntie. Everybody's favorite auntie. We're dancing in the streets with Silly and Sissy. We're going on adventures. I'll be your best friend. I'm Silly and Sissy, and I'll be your best friend today. You can trust me with anything, and I'll bring a big smile. So thanks for joining Silly and Sissy's adventures. And let's get to it. Let's have some fun. Let's read a story. And now we're reading Christmas Carol for the family. And tomorrow we'll move on to Boxcar Children in a couple days. But in honor, I've got to tell you this, in honor of the Russian Christmas, which is coming up very soon. That's right, boys and girls and kids and kiddos and moms and dads and grandparents. The Russians celebrate Christmas after us because they use a different calendar. That's right. So they use a different calendar and they celebrate at the beginning of January after New Year's. So very interesting. Isn't that just? So in honor of that, we're finishing up Christmas Carol. We're on chapter 3, the second of three spirits. Awakening in the middle of a prodigiously tough snore and sitting up in bed to get his thoughts. That means a very loud snore. Scrooge had no occasion to be told that the bell was again upon the stroke of midnight. Of one, rather. He felt that he was restored to consciousness in the right nick of time for the especial purpose of holding a conference with the second messenger dispatched to him through Jacob Marley's intervention. But finding that he turned uncomfortably cold when he began to wonder of his curtains, the new spectre would draw back. He put them every one again with his own hands and, lying down again, established a sharp look out all around the bed. For he wished to challenge a spirit on the moment of its appearance, and did not wish to be taken by surprise and made nervous. Gentlemen of the free and easy sort, who plumb themselves on being acquainted with a move or two, and being usually equal to the time of day, express the wide range of their captivity for adventure by observing that they are good for anything from pitch and toss to manslaughter, between which opposite extremes, no doubt, there lies a tolerably wide and comprehensive range of subjects. Without venturing for Scrooge quite as hardly as this, I don't mind calling on you to believe that he was ready for a good broad field of strange appearances, and that nothing between a baby and a rhinoceros would have astonished him very much. Now, being prepared for almost anything, he was not by any means prepared for nothing. And consequently, when the bell struck one and no shape appeared, he was taken with a violent fit of trembling. 5 minutes, 10 minutes, a quarter of an hour went by, yet nothing came. All this time he lay upon his bed, the very core and center of a blaze of ruddy light, which streamed upon it with the clock proclaimed the hour, in which, being only light, was more alarming than a dozen ghosts, as he was powerless to make out what it meant, or would be at was, and sometimes apprehensive that he might be at that very moment an interesting case of spontaneous combustion, without having the conclusion of knowing it. At last, however, he began to think, as you or I would have thought at first, for it is always the person not in the predicament who knows what ought to have been done in it, and would unquestionably have done it, too. At last, I say, he began to think that the source and secret of the ghostly light might be in the adjoining room, from where on further tracing it, it seemed to shine. This idea taking full possession of his mind, he got up softly and shuffled in his slippers to the door. The moment Scrooge's hand was on the lock, a strange voice called him by his name and bade him enter. He obeyed. It was his own room. There was no doubt about that. But it had undergone a surprising transformation. The walls and ceiling were so hung with living green that it looked like a perfect grove, from every part of which bright gleaming berries glistened. The crisp leaves of holly, mistletoe, and ivy reflected back the light, and as if many little mirrors had been scattered there. And such a mighty blaze went roaring up the chimney as that dull preservation of a hearth had never known in Scrooge's time, or Marley's, or for many a winter season gone. Heaped upon the floor to form a kind of throne, where turkeys, geese, game, poultry, brawn, great jaunts of meat, sucking pigs, long wreaths of sausages, and mince pies, plum puddings, barrels of oysters, red-hot chestnuts, cherry-picked apples, juicy oranges, luscious pears, immense 12 cakes, and seething bowls of punch that made the chamber dim with their delicious steam. In easy state upon this couch, there sat a jolly giant, glorious to see, who bore a clumbing torch in shape not unlike Pliny's horn. "Come in!" exclaimed the ghost. "Come in, and know me better, man." Scrooge entered timidly and hung his head before the spirit. He was not the dogged Scrooge he had been, and though the spirit's eyes were clear and kind, he did not like to meet them. "I am the ghost of Christmas present," said the spirit. "Look upon me." Scrooge reverently did so. That means, not really wanting to. Scrooge didn't want to, but he did anyway. It was clothed in a simple, deep green robe, mantle bordered with white fur. The garnet hung so loosely on the figure that its captious breast was bare, as if disdaining to be waddled or concealed by an artifact. Its feet, observable beneath the ample folds of the garnet, were also bare, and on its head of it wore no other covering than a holly wreath set there, and there with shining icicles, its dark brown curls were long and free as its general place. Its sparkling eye, its open hand, its cheery voice, its unconstrained demeanor, attitude, and its joyful air, girded around its middle, was an antique scabbard, but no sword was in it, and the ancient sheath was eaten up with rust. You have never seen the like of me before," exclaimed the spirit. "Never," Scrooge made answer to it. "Have never walked forth with the younger members of my family, meaning, for I am very young. My elder brothers, born in these later years," pursued the phantom. "I don't think I have," said Scrooge. "I'm afraid I have not. Have you had many brothers, spirit?" "More than 1,800," said the ghost. "Oh, a tremendous family to provide for," muttered Scrooge. The ghost of Christmas present rose. "Spirit, conduct me where you will. I went forth last night on compulsion, and I learned a lesson which is working now. Tonight, if you have aught to teach me, let me profit by it. Touch my robe." Scrooge did as he was told and held it fast. Holly, mistletoe, red berries, ivy, turkeys, geese, game, poultry, brawn, meat, pig, sausage, oyster paste, puddings, fruit, and punch all vanished instantly. So did the room, the fire, the ruddy glow, the hour of the night, and they stood in the city streets on Christmas morning. The people made a rough but brisk and not unpleasant kind of music in scraping the snow from the pavement in front of their dwellings and from the tops of their houses, whence it was made delight to the boys to see it come pumping down into the road below and splitting into artificial little snowstorms. The house fronts looked back enough, and the windows blacker, constructing with the smooth white sheet of snow upon the roofs and with the dirtier snow upon the ground, which last deposit had been plumped up in deep furrows by the heavy wheels of carts and wagons, furrows that crossed and recrossed each other hundreds of times, where the great streets branched off and made intricate channels, hard to trace in the thick yellow mud and icy water. The sky was gloomy, and the shortest streets were choked up with a dingy mist, half thawed, half frozen, whose heavier particles descended in a shower of sooty atoms, as if all the chimneys in Great Britain had by one consent caught fire and were blazing away to their dear heart's content. There was nothing very cheerful in the climate or the town, and yet there is an air of cheerfulness abroad that the clearest summer air and brightest summer sun might have endeavored to diffuse in vain. Oh my, in vain. Wow. In vain, dear spirits. In vain indeed. Intermission time. Intermission time. Intermission time. So we sing a little sixpence. Alright. For the people who were shoveling away on the housetops were joyful and full of glee, calling out to one another from the parapets, now and then exchanging a fictitious snowball, better-natured missile, far than many a word, just laughing heartily if it went right, and less heartily if it went wrong. There were great round pot-bellied baskets of chestnuts shaped like the waistcoats of jolly old gentlemen. There were ruddy brown-faced, broad-girthed Spanish onions shining in the fatness of the growth like Spanish friars, and winking from their shelves in wanton silence at the girls as they went by, and glanced demurely at the hung-up mistletoe. There were pears and apples clustered high in the blooming pyramids. There were bunches of grapes made in the shopkeeper's benevolence to dangle from conspicuous hooks that people's mouths might water gracious as they passed. There were piles of filberts, mossy and brown, recalling in their fragrance ancient walks among the wood and pleasant shufflings and ankle deep through withered leaves. There were Norwalk biffins, squab, and swarthy settling off of the yellow of the oranges and lemons in the great compactness of their juicy persons, urgently entreating and beseeching to be carried home in the paper bags and eaten after dinner. The very golden silverfish set forth among those choice fruits in a bowl through members of a dull and stagnant-blooded race. Well, I'm very surprised here. This is very odd. Huh. Well, there's Auntie Sissy is very concerned. Silly Aunt Sissy is very concerned because there's a lot of pages that don't even make sense. There's like a whole different story in here. But that's it. And on to fish. When grasping round, I'll read it after this. The grocers, oh, the grocers, nearly closed with perhaps two shutters down, or one, but through these geese, such glimpses. It was not alone that the scales descending on the counter made a merry sound, or that the twine and roller parted company so briskly, or that the canisters were rattled up and down like jiggling tricks, or even that the blended scents of tea and coffee were so grateful to the nose, or even the raisins were so plentiful and rare, the almonds so excitedly white, the sticks of cinnamon so long and straight. Nor was it that the figs were moist and pulpy, or the French plums blushed in modest tartness. But the customers were all so hurried and so eager in the hopeful promise of the day that they tumbled against each other at the door, crashing their wicker baskets wildly, and left their purchases upon the counter, and came running back to fetch them, and committed hundreds of like mistakes in the best humor possible, while the grocer and his people were so frank and fresh, the polished hearts which would they fastened their aprons behind might have been their own. But soon the staples called good people all to church and chapel, and away they came flocking through the streets in their best clothes, and with their gayest faces, and at the same time there emerged from scores of streets, lanes, and nameless turnings, the sight of these poor revealers appeared to interest the spirit very much, for he stood with Scrooge beside him. He shed a few drops of water on them from it, and their good humor was restored directly. For they said it was a shame to quarrel upon Christmas Day, and so it was. God love it, so it was. Everyone was very... There was a little storm and a little fight, but it's all good. In time the bells ceased, and the bakers were shut up, and yet there was a general shadowing forth of all these dinners. Is there a particular favor in what you sprinkle from your torch? There is, my own. Would it apply to any kind of dinner on this day? Asked Scrooge. To any kindly given to a poor one most. Why to a poor one most? Because it needs it most. Spirit, I wonder you, of all the beings in the many worlds about us, should desire to cramp these people's opportunities of innocent enjoyment. I, cried the spirit, you would deprive them of any other means of dining every seventh day? I, cried the spirit, you seek to close these places on the seventh day, and it comes to the exact same thing. I seek, exclaimed the spirit, forgive me if I am wrong. It has been done in your name, or at least in that of your family. There are some upon us, this earth of yours, returned the spirit, who claimed to know us, who knew do their deeds of passion. Scrooge promised that he would look into it all, and they went on, invisible as they had been before, into the suburbs of the town. It was a remarkable quality of the ghost that, notwithstanding his gigantic size, he could accommodate himself to any place with ease, and that he stood beneath a low roof, quiet as gracefully, and like a supernatural creature, as if it was possible he could have done it in any lofty hall. And perhaps it was the pleasure the good spirit had in showing off his power of his, or else it was his own kind, generous, hearty nature. Scrooge with him holding to his rope, and on the threshold of the door, the spirit smiled and stopped the blessed Bob Cratchit's dwelling with the sprinkling of his torch. Think of that, Bob had but 15. Bob, a week himself, he pocketed on Saturdays but 15 copies of his Christian name, and yet the ghost of Christmas present blessed his four-roomed house. Then rose up Mrs. Cratchit, Cratchit's wife, dressed out but poorly in a twice-turned gown, but brave in ribbons, which are cheap and make a godly show for sixpence. And she laid the cloth, assisted by Belinda Cratchit, also brave in ribbons. While Master Peter Cratchit plunged a fork into the saucepan of potatoes, and getting the corner of his monstrous shirt collar into his mouth, rejoiced to find himself so gaily attired, and yearned to show his linen in the fashionable parks. And now two smaller Cratchit boys and girl came tearing in, screaming the outside, that outside the baker's they had smelled the goose and known it for their own, and basking in luxurious thoughts of sage and onion, these young Cratchits danced about the table and excelled Master Peter Cratchit to the skies, while he blew the fire until the slow potatoes, bubbling up, knocked loudly at the saucepan lid to be let out and peeled. What has ever gotten your precious father, said Mrs. Cratchit, and your brother Tiny Tim, and Martha weren't as last Christmas Day by half an hour. Here's Martha's mother. Here's Martha's mother, cried the two young Cratchits. Hooray, there's such a goose, Martha. Why, bless your heart alive, my dear. How late you are. We'd had a lot of work to finish up last night, and had to clear away this morning, mother. Well, never mind, so long as you're come. Sit ye down before the fire, my dear, and have a warm... Lord bless ye. No, no, there's father coming, cried the two young Cratchits. Hide, Martha, hide. So Martha hid herself, and in came little Bob, the father, with at least 3 feet of comforter exclusive of the fringe hanging down before him, and his threadbare clothes darned up and brushed to look seasonable, and Teeny Tim upon his shoulder. Alas for Teeny Tim, He bore a little crutch and had his limbs supported by an iron frame. "Why, where's our Martha?" cried Bob Cratchit, looking round. "Not coming," said Mrs. Cratchit. "Not coming," said Bob, with a sudden declension in his high spirits, for he had seen Tim's horse drawn all the way from church. "Not coming upon Christmas Day?" Martha didn't like to see him disappointed. For only a joke, so he came out prematurely from behind the closet door and ran into his arms while the two young Cratchits hustled Teeny Tim and bore him off to the wash house. "And how did little Tim behave?" asked Mrs. Cratchit, when she had rallied Bob on his meanness, and Bob had hugged his daughter to his heart's content. "As good as gold. Somehow he gets thoughtful sitting by himself so much, and thinks the strangest things you've ever heard. He told me coming home that he hoped the people saw him in the church because he was a cripple, and it might be pleasant to them to remember upon Christmas Day who made lame beggars walk and blind men see." Bob's voice was tremulous when he told them this, and trembled more when he said that. Teeny Tim was growing strong and hearty. His active little crutch was hard upon the floor, and back came Teeny Tim before another word was spoken, escorted by his brother and sister to a stool beside the fire, and while Bob turned up his cuffs, as if, poor fellow, there was capable of being made more shabby, compounded some hot mixture in a jug. Master Peter and the two ambitious young Cratchits went to fetch the goose, with which they soon returned in high procession. Such a bustle ensued that you might have thought a goose the rarest of all birds, a feathered phenomenon to which a black swan was a matter of course, and in truth it was something very like it in that house. Mrs. Cratchit made the gravy, hissing hot. Master Peter mashed the potatoes with incredible vigor. Miss Belinda sweetened up the applesauce. Martha dusted the hot plates. Bob took Teeny Tim beside him in a teeny corner of the table. Cratchit set chairs for everybody, not forgetting themselves, and mounting guard upon their post, should shriek for goose before their turn came to be helped. It was succeeded by a breathless pause as Mrs. Cratchit, looking slowly all along the carving knife, prepared to plunge it into the breast. But when she did, and when the long-expected gush of stuffing issued forth, one murmur of delight arose all around the board, and even Tiny Tim, excited by the two young Cratchits, beat on the table with the handle of his knife, and feebly cried, "Hooray!" "There never was such a goose," Bob said. He didn't believe there was ever such a goose cooked. Its tenderness and flavor, size and cheapness were the themes of the universal admiration, acted out by applesauce and mashed potatoes. Indeed, as Mrs. Cratchit said with great delight, they hadn't ate it all at last. They hadn't ate it all at last, yet everyone had enough, and the youngest Cratchits in particular were steeped in sage and onion to the eyebrows. But now, the plate being changed by Miss Belinda, Mrs. Cratchit left the room alone. Suppose it should not be done enough. Suppose it should break in turning out. Suppose somebody should have gotten over the wall of the backyard and stolen it while they were merry with the goose. Hello, a great deal of steam. The pudding was out of the copper. It smelled like a washing day. That was the cloth. It smelled like an eating house and pastry cook next door to each other. That was the pudding. In half a minute, Mrs. Cratchit entered, flushed, but smiling proudly with the pudding like a speckled cannonball. Oh, wonderful pudding, Bob Cratchit said, and calmly, too, that he regarded it as the greatest success achieved by Mrs. Cratchit. Mrs. Cratchit said that now the weight was off her mind, she would confess she had her doubts about the quality of flour. At last the dinner was all done, the cloth was cleared, the compound in the jug being tasted and considered perfect apples. Then all the Cratchits fell. The Cratchit family drew around the hearth in what Bob Cratchit called a circle. These held the hot stuff from the jug, however, as well as golden goblets would have done, and Bob served it out with beaming looks while the chestnuts on the fire spurted. Then Bob proposed, "A Merry Christmas to all, my dears. God bless us." "God bless us, every one," said Teeny Tim, the last of all. He sat very close to his father's side upon the stool. Bob held his withered little hand in his as if he loved the child and wished to keep him by his side and dreaded that he might be taken from him. "Spirit," said Scrooge, "tell me if Tiny Tim will live. I see a vacant seat in the poor chimney corner and a crutch without an owner. If these shadows remain unaltered by the future, the child will die." "No, no," said Scrooge. "Oh, no, kind spirit, say he will be spared. If these shadows remain unaltered by the future, none other of my race," returned the ghost, "will find him here. What then? If he'd be like to die, he had better do it and decrease the population." Scrooge hung his head to hear his own words quoted by the spirit, and was overcome with penitence and grief. "Man, if man you be in heart, not admit, forbear that wicked cant until you have discovered what the surplus is and where it is. Will you decide what man shall live, what man shall die? It may be that in the sight of heaven you are more worthless and less let fit to live than millions like this poor man's child. Oh God, to hear the insect on the leaf pronouncing one on the too much life among his hungry brothers in the dust." Scrooge bent before the ghost revoke in trembling, but he raised him on hearing his own name. "Mr. Scrooge," said Bob, "I'll give you Mr. Scrooge, the founder of the feast." "The founder of the feast, indeed," cried Mrs. Cratchit, reddening. "I wish I had him here. I'd give him a piece of my mind to feast upon, and I'd hope he'd have a good appetite for it. My dear, the children, Christmas Day. It should be Christmas Day, I am sure, on which one drinks the health of such an odious, stingy, hard, unfeeling man as Mr. Scrooge. You know he is, Robert. Nobody knows it better than you, dear fellow." "My dear," was Bob's mild answer, "Christmas Day." "I'll drink in his health for your sake, and the day's," said Mrs. Cratchit, "not for his life. Long life to him, a merry Christmas and a happy New Year. He'll be very merry and very happy, I have no doubt." The children drank the toast after her. It was the first of their proceedings, which had no heartness in it. Tiny Trim drank it last of all, but he didn't care twopence for it. Scrooge was the org of the family. The mention of the name cast a dark shadow on the party. After it had passed away, there was 10 minutes merrier than before from the mere relief of Scrooge, the bayful before doing with. Bob Cratchit had told him how he had a situation in his eye for Master Peter, which bring in, if obtained, full 5 and 6 pence weekly. The two young Cratchits laughed tremendously at the idea of Peter being a man of business, and Peter himself looked thoughtfully at the fire from between his collars as he were deliberating what particular investments he should favor when he came into the receipt of that bewildering income. Martha, who was a poor apprentice of a miner's, then told him what kind of work she had to do and how many hours she worked at the stretch and how she meant to lie around tomorrow morning for a good long rest. Also, had she seen a countless and the Lord some days before, and how the Lord was much about as tall as Peter, at which Peter pulled up his collar so that you couldn't have seen his head. All the time the chestnuts and the jug went round and round, and by they had a song about a lost child traveling in the snow from Teeny Tim, who had a plaintive little voice and sang it very well indeed. There was nothing of high mark in this. They were not a handsome family. They were not well dressed. Their shoes were far from being waterproof. Their clothes were scanty, and Peter might have known, and very likely did, the inside of a pawnbroker's. But they were happy and grateful, pleased with one another, and contented with the time, and when they faded and looked happier yet in the bright sprinklings of the spirit's torch at parting. By the time it was getting dark, and by this time it was getting dark and snowing pretty heavily, and as Scrooge and the spirit went along the streets, the brightness of the roaring fires in the kitchen parlors and all the rooms was wonderful. Here the flickering of the blaze showed preparedness for a cozy dinner. There all the children of the house were running out into the snow to meet their married sisters, brothers, cousins, uncles, aunt, and be the first to greet them. Here again were shadows on the window blades of guests assembling, and there a group of handsome girls, all hooded and far booted and all chattering at once. But if you had judged them from the numbers of people on their way to friendly gatherings, you might have thought that no one was at home to give them welcome when they got there. Instead of every house expecting company, blessings on it, how the ghost exulted, how it barred in breath of breast and opened its capacious palm and floated on. The very lamplighter who ran on the floor, dotting the dusky street with specks of light, and whose dress so spend the evening somewhere, laughed out loud as the spirit passed the little kennel, the lamplighter, he had any company but Christmas. And now, without a word of warning from the ghost, stood upon a bleak and desert moor, where masses of rude stone were cast about as though it were the burial place of giants. "What kind of place is this?" asked Scrooge. "A place where miners live, who labor in the boughs, but they..." returned the spirit, "but they know me. See?" A light shone from the window of a hut, and swiftly they advanced toward it, passing through the wall of mud. The old man, in the voice that seldom rose above the howling of the wind upon the barren waste, was singing them a Christmas song. It had been a very old song when he was a boy, and from time to time they all joined in the chorus, so surely as they raised their voices, the old man got quiet, blithe, and loud, and so surely as they stopped, his vigor sank again. The spirit did not tarry here, but made Scrooge hold his robe, to Scrooge's horror. Looking back, he saw the last of the land, a frightful range of rocks, built upon a dismal reef of sunken rocks, some leagues or so from shore, in which the waters chafed. Great heaps of sea wood clung to its base, but even here two men who watched the light had made a fire that shone the loophole in the thick stone wall shed. Joining their horny hands over the rough table at which they sat, they wished each other Merry Christmas. Again the ghost sped on above the black and heaving sea, on and on until being far away, as he told Scrooge, from any shore, they lightened on a ship. They stood beside the helmsman at the wheel. The officers who had the watch, dark ghostly figures in their several stations, but every man among them hummed a Christmas tune, a Christmas thought, or spoke of below to his breath to his companion of some bygone Christmas day with homeward hopes belonging to it. And every man on board, walking or sleeping, good or bad, had a kinder word for one another on that day in the year, and had shared to some extent in his festivities. It was a great surprise to Scrooge, while listening to the moaning of the wind and thinking about what solemn things it was to move on through the lonely darkness over an unknown bias. "Ha!" laughed Scrooge. "Scratch you. Ha! Ha!" Now they were at Scrooge's nephew's house. If you happen by any unlikely chance to know a man more blessed in a laugh than Scrooge's nephew, all I can say is I should like to know him. His fair, even-handed, noble adjustment of things, that while there is infection and disease and sorrow, there is nothing in the world so irresistibly contiguous as laughter. When Scrooge's nephew laughed in this way, holding his sides, rolling his head, Scrooge's niece by marriage laughed as heartily as he. "Ha, ha, 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 ha," he said, "that Christmas was a humbug, as I live. He believed it, too. More shame for him, Fred. Bless these women, they never do anything by halves." She was very pretty, exceedingly pretty, with a dimpled, surprising look. "Here's a comical old fellow." "He's a comical old fellow," said Scrooge's nephew. "That's the truth, and not so pleasant as he might be. However, his offenses carry their own punishment, and I have nothing to say against him. I'm sure he is very rich, Fred, at least you always tell me so." "What of that, my dear? His wealth is of no use to us. He doesn't do any good with it. He doesn't make himself comfortable with it. He hasn't the satisfaction of thinking." "I have no patience with him," observed Scrooge's niece. Scrooge's niece's sister and all the other ladies expressed the same opinion. "Oh, I have," said Scrooge's nephew. "I'm sorry for him. I couldn't be angry with him if I tried. Who suffers by his own ill whims? Himself always. Here he takes it into his head to dislike us, and he won't come and dine with us. He doesn't lose much of a dinner." What's the consequence? He doesn't lose much of a dinner. Indeed, I think he loses a very good dinner, interrupted Scrooge's niece. Everybody else said the same, and they must be allowed to have been competent judges, because they had just had dinner, and with the dessert upon them, the table was clustered round the fire by lamplight. Well, I'm very glad to hear it, said Scrooge's nephew, because I haven't any great faith in those young housekeepers. What do you say, Topper? Topper had clearly got his eye upon one of Scrooge's niece's sisters, for he answered that a bachelor was a wretched outcast who had no right to express an opinion on the subject. Go on, Fred. He never finishes what he begins to say. He's such a ridiculous fellow. I was only going to say, said Scrooge's nephew, that the consequences of his taking a dislike to us and not making merry with us is I think that he loses some pleasant moments when he could do harm no harm. I am sure he loses pleasanter companions than he can find in his own thoughts. I mean to give him the same chance every year, whether he likes it or not, for I pity him. He may rail at Christmas till he dies, but he can't help thinking better of it. I defy him if he finds me going there in a good temper year after year and saying, Uncle Scrooge, how are you? If only puts him in the vein to leave his poor clerkie £50, and that's something. And I think I shook him yesterday. It was their turn to laugh now at the idea of his shaking Scrooge, but being thoroughly good-natured and not much caring what they laughed at, so that they laughed at any rate, he encouraged them in their merriment. After tea, they had some music, for they were a musical family and knew what they were about. I can assure you, especially Topper, who could growl every away in the bass like a good one, and never swell the large veins in his forehead. Scrooge's niece played well upon the harp and played, among other tunes, the simple little air, which had been familiar to the child who fetched Scrooge from the boarding school, as he had been reminded by the ghost of Christmas past, when the strain of musical sounded all the things that ghost had shown him come upon his mind. He softened more and more and thought that if he could have listened to it often years ago, he might have cultivated the kindness of life. But they didn't devote the whole evening to music. After a while, they played at Fortress, for it is good to have be children sometimes, and never better than at Christmas, when its mighty founder was a child himself. Stop! There was first a game at Blindman's Bluff. Of course there was, and I no more believe Topper was really blind than I believe he had eyes in his boots. My opinion is that it was a done thing between him and Scrooge's nephew, and that the ghost of Christmas present knew it. The way he went after that plump sister and Lace Tucker was an outrage. Knocking down the fire icons, tumbling over the chairs, he always knew where the plump sister was. If you had fallen up against him on purpose, he would have made a feign and daring seize to you. But when at last he caught her, when in spite of all their silken wrestlings, he got her into a corner whence there was no escape, for his pretending not to know her, his pretending that was necessary to touch her headdress and further to assure himself her identity. No doubt she told him her opinion of it when, another blind man being in office, they were very confidential together. Scrooge's niece was not one of the blind man's buff party, but was made comfortable with a large chair and a footstool, where the ghost and Scrooge were close behind her, but she joined in the forces and loved her life and in admiration with all the letters of the alphabet. Likewise, at the game of how, when, and where, she was very great. There might have been 20 people there, young and old, but they all played, and so did Scrooge, for wholly forgetting in that interest he had in what was going on, that his voice made no sound in their ears. He sometimes came out with the guess quite loud, and very often guessed right, too. The ghost was greatly pleased to find himself in this mood, and looked upon him with such favor that he begged like a boy to be allowed to stay until the guest departed. But this, the spirit said, could not be done. Here is a new game, 1/2 hour, spirit, only one. It was a game called Yes and No, where Scrooge's nephew had to think of something, and the rest might find out what he, by only answering to their questions yes or no, as the case was. The brisk fire of questioning to which he was exposed elicited that he was thinking of an animal. and talked sometimes and lived in London and walked about the streets, led by anybody and didn't live in the world, was never killed in a market, and was not a horse or an ass or a cow or a bull or a tiger or a dog or a pig or a cat or a bear. At every fresh question there was put to him, this nephew burst into a fresh roar of laughter and was so impressively tickled that he was obliged to get off the sofa and stamp. "I have found out. I know what it is, Fred. I know what it is. It's your Uncle Scrooge," which it certainly was. Admiration was the universal sentiment. "He has given us plenty of merriment, I'm sure," said Fred, "and be ungrateful not to drink it to his health. Here is a glass of mulled wine ready to our hand at the moment." And I say, "Uncle Scrooge." "Well, Uncle Scrooge," they cried, "and Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to the old man, whatever he is," said Scrooge's nephew. "He wouldn't take it from me, but may he have it nonetheless, Uncle Scrooge." Uncle Scrooge had impersonally become so gay and light of heart that he would have pledged the unconscious company in return. But the whole scene passed off in the breath of the last words spoken by his nephew, and he and the spirit again were upon their travels. Much they saw, and far they went, and many homes they visited, but always with a happy end. The spirit stood beside sick beds, and they were cheerful on foreign lands, and they were close at home by struggling men, and almost hospital and jail and misery, every refuge where a vain man in his little brief authority had not made fast the door and barred the spirit out. He left his blessings and taught Scrooge it. Well, it was a long night, if it were only a night, but Scrooge had his doubts of this, because the Christmas holidays appeared to be condensed into the space of time they passed together. The ghost grew older, clearly older. Scrooge had observed the change, but never spoke of it until they left the children's 12th night party, when looking at the spirit. "Are spirits' light so short? My life upon this globe is very brief. It ends tonight." "Tonight?" cried Scrooge. "Tonight at midnight. The time is drawing near. The chimes are ringing the 11:15 at that moment. Forgive me if I'm not justified in what I ask, but I see something strange and not belonging to yourself protruding from your skirts. Is that a foot or a claw?" "It might be a claw, for the flesh there is upon it. Look here." From the foldings of its robe it brought two children, wrenched by, frightened, hideous, miserable. They knelt down at its feet and clung upon the outside of its garment. "Oh, man, look here, look down here," exclaimed the ghost. "They are a boy and a girl, yellow, meager, and rage, scowling with wolfish, but in their humanity. Where graceful youth should have filled their features out and touched them with its freshest tints, a stale and shriveled hand, like that of age, had pinched and twisted them and pulled them into shreds. Where angels might have sat enthroned, devils lurk and guarded out, mincing. No chance, no degradation, no perseverance of humanity in any grade through all the mysteries of wonderful creation. His masters half so horrible and dread. Scrooge started back appalled, having them shown to him in this way, but the words choked themselves rather than them be parties to a lie of such enormous magnitude. "Spirit, are they yours?" Scrooge could say no more. "They are man," said the spirit, looking down upon them. "And they cling to me, appealing from their fathers. The boy is ignorance, the girl is want. Beware of them both, and all of their degree, but most of all, beware of this boy, for on his own brow I see that written which is doom, unless the writing be erased. Deny it," called the spirit, stretching out his hand toward the city. "Slander those who tell it ye. Admit it for your fastenous purpose, and make it worse, and bid the end." "Have they no refuge, no resource?" cried Scrooge. "Are there no prisons?" said the spirit, turning on him for the last time with his own words. "Are there no workhouses?" The bell struck 12. Scrooge looked upon them for the ghost and saw it not. At the last stroke ceased to vibrate, he remembered the prediction of old Marley, and lifting up his eyes, beheld a solemn phantom draped and hooded coming like a mist along the ground toward him. The Last of the Spirits, stave 4. Wow, that was a long one. Well, Silly Aunt Sissy says, "Good night, goodbye, farewell, see you real soon. Thanks for listening to all the adventures today of Mr. Scrooge. Well, what will happen? Oh my, I guess we'll find out tomorrow. Bye, good night, goodbye, farewell, see you real soon.